Hands. "Hod credi colori," said Stephen. "Cast your eyes aloft, my dear sir." Mr. White looked up at the mizzen peak, where a tricolour streamed out bravely. "It's the French flag," he cried. "No, the Dutch. We're sailing under false colours. Can such things be?" "So are they," said Stephen. "They seek to amuse us, we seek to amuse them. The iniquity is evenly divided. It's an accepted convention, I find, like bidding the servant..." A shot from the Semillant's bow chaser threw up a plume of water a little way from the frigate's stern, and the parson started back. "Say you are not at home, when in fact you are eating muffin by your fire and do not choose to be disturbed." "I often did so," said Mr. White, whose face had grown strangely mottled. "God forgive me. And now here I am in the midst of battle. I never thought such a thing could happen. I'm a man of peace. However, I must not give a bad example." A ball, striking the top of a wave, ricocheted onto the quarter-deck by way of the neatly piled hammocks. It fell with a harmless dump, and two midshipmen darted for it, struggled briefly until the stronger wrested it away and wrapped it lovingly in his jacket. "Good heavens!" cried Mr. White. "To fire great iron balls at people you've never even spoken to? Barbarity's come again." "Will you take a turn, sir?" asked Stephen. "Willingly, sir, if you... don't think I should stand here to show I don't care for these ruffians. But I bow to your superior knowledge of warfare. Will the captain stay up there on the mast in that exposed position?"
"I dare say he will," said Stephen. "I dare say he's turning over the situation in his mind."
Certainly he was. It was clear that his first duty, having reconnoitred the enemy, was to reach the China fleet and do everything possible to preserve it. Nor had he the least doubt that he could outsail the Frenchmen with their foul bottoms. Indeed, even if they'd been clean, he could no doubt have given them a good deal of canvas, fine ships though they were, for it was they who had built the Surprise and he who was sailing her. It stood to reason that an Englishman could handle a ship better than a Frenchman. Yet Lenoir was not to be underestimated, the fox. He'd chased Jack in the Mediterranean through a long summer's day, and he had caught him. The two-decker, now so near that her identity was certain, the Marengo, 74, wearing a rear admiral's flag, had worn. And now she was close-hauled on the larboard tack, followed by the fourth ship and the distant brig. The fourth ship must be the Berceau, a 22-gun corvette. The brig he knew nothing about. Lenoir had worn. He had not tacked. That meant he was favouring his ship. Those three, the Marengo, Berceau, and the brig, standing on the opposite tack, meant to cut him off if the frigates managed to head him. That was obvious, greyhounds either side of a hare turning her. The last shot came a little too close. Excellent practice at this extreme range. It would be a pity to have any ropes cut away. "Mr. Starton," he called, "shake out a reef in the foretopsail and haul the bowlines." The Surprise leapt forward in spite of her drag sail. The Semillant was leaving the Belle Poule far behind and to leeward. He knew that he could draw her on and on, then bear up suddenly and bring her to close action. Hammer her hard with his 32-pounder carronades, and perhaps sink or take her before her friends could come up. The temptation made his breath come short. Glory, and the only prize in the Indian Ocean. The pleasing image of billowing smoke, the flash of guns, masts falling, faded almost at once and his heart returned to its dutiful, calculating pace. He must not endanger a single spar. His frigate must join the China fleet at all costs and intact. His present course was taking Lenoir straight towards the Indiaman. Half a day's sail away to the east, strung out over miles of sea, quite unsuspecting. Clearly, he must lead the Frenchman away by some lame duck ruse, even if it meant losing his comfortable weather gauge. Lead them away until nightfall, and then beat up, trusting to the darkness and the surprise's superior sailing, to shake them off and reach the convoy in time. He could go about and head southeast until about 10 o'clock. By then he should have fore-reached upon Lenoir so far that he could bear up cross ahead of him in the darkness and so double back. Yet if he did so, or offered to do so, Lenoir, that deep old file, might order the pursuing frigates to hold on to their northerly course, stretching to windward of the surprise and gaining the weather gauge. That'd be awkward in the morning, for fast though she was, she couldn't outrun Semillon and Belle Poule if they were sailing large and she was beating up, as she would have to beat up, tack after tack, to warn the China fleet. But then again, if Lenoir did that, if he ordered his frigates northwards, a gap would appear in his dispositions after a quarter of an hour's sailing, a gap through which the surprise could dart, bearing up suddenly and running before the wind with all the sail she could spread, and passing between the Belle Poule and the Marengo, out of range of either. For Lenoir's dispositions were based upon the chase moving at 9 or 10 knots. No European ship in these waters could do better, and hitherto surprise hadn't done as well. Verso, the corvette, farther to leeward, might close the gap, but although she might knock away some of his spars, it was unlikely that she could hold him long enough for the Marengo to come up. If she had a commander so determined that he would let his ship be riddled, perhaps sunk, a man who would run him aboard, why then that would be a different matter. He looked hard over the sea at the distant corvette. She vanished in a drift of rain, and he shifted his gaze to the two-decker. What was in Lenoir's mind? He was running east-southeast under easy sail. Topsails, forecourse clued up. One thing Jack was certain of was that Lenoir was infinitely more concerned with catching the China fleet than with destroying a frigate. The moves, the answers to those moves on either side, the varying degrees of danger, and above all, Lenoir's appreciation of the position. He came down on deck, and Stephen, looking attentively at him, saw that he had what might be called his battle face. It was not the glowing blaze of immediate action, of boarding or cutting out, but a remoter expression altogether. Cheerful, confident, but withdrawn, filled with natural authority. He didn't speak, apart from giving an order to hitch the runners to the mastheads and to double the preventer backstays, but paced the quarterdeck with his hands behind his back, his eyes running from the frigates to the line of battleship. Stephen saw the first lieutenant approach, hesitate, and step back. On these occasions, he reflected, my valuable friend appears to swell, actually to increase in his physical as well as his spiritual dimensions. Is it an optical illusion? How I should like to measure him. The penetrating intelligence in the eye, however, is not capable of measurement. He becomes a stranger. I, too, should hesitate to address him. "Mr. Stoughton," said Jack,
We will go about. Yes, sir. Shall I cast off the drag sail, sir?
No.
And we will not go about too fast, neither. Space out the orders, if you please. As the pipes screeched all hands about ship, he stood on the hammocks, fixing the Marengo with his glass, pivoting as the frigate turned up into the wind. Just after the cry of mainsail haul and the sharp cutting pipe of belay, he saw a signal run up aboard the flagship and the puff of a gun on her poop. The Semyant and the Belle Poule had begun their turn in pursuit. But now the Semyant paid off again and stood on. The Belle Poule was already past the eye of the wind, when a second gun emphasized the order to stand on northwards and gain the weather gauge. And she had to wear right round to come up onto her former tack. "Damn that," murmured Jack. The blunder would narrow his precious gap by quarter of a mile. He glanced at the sun and at his watch. "Mr. Church," he said, "be so good as to fetch me a mango." The minutes passed. The juice ran down his chin. The French frigates stood on to the north-northwest, growing smaller. First the Semyant, and then the Belle Poule crossed the wake of the Surprise, gaining the weather gauge. There was no changing his mind now. The Marengo, her two tiers of guns clearly to be seen, lay on the starboard beam, sailing a parallel course. There was no sound but the high, steady note of the wind in the rigging and the beat of the sea on the frigate's larboard bow. The far-spaced ships scarcely seemed to move in relation to one another from one minute to the next. There seemed to be all the peaceful room in the world. The Marengo dropped her foresail. The angle widened half a degree. Jack checked all the positions yet again, looked at his watch, looked at the dog vane, and said, "Mr. Stoughton, the stunsails are in the tops, I believe."
"Yes, sir."
"Very well. In 10 minutes we must cast off the drag sail, bear up, set royals, stunsails aloft and alow, if she'll bear them, and bring the wind 2 points on the quarter. We must make sail as quick as ever sail was made, braining up the driver and hauling down the staysails at the same time, of course. Send Clark and Bondon to the wheel. Lower the starboard port lids, make all ready, and stand by to let go the drag sail when I give the signal." Still, the minutes dropped by. The critical point was coming, but slowly. Slowly. Jack, motionless upon that busy deck, began to whistle softly as he watched the far-off Linois. But then he checked himself. He wanted no more than a brisk to gallant breeze. Anything more, or anything like a hollow sea, would favour the two-decker, the tall, far heavier ship. And he knew to his cost how fast these big French 74s could move. A last glance to windward. The forces were exactly balanced. The moment had come. He drew a deep breath, tossed the hairy mango stone over the side and shouted, "Let go there!" An instant splash. "Hard a port!" The Surprise turned on her heel, her yards coming round to admiration, sails flashing out as others vanished, and there, close on her starboard quarter, was her foaming wake, showing a sweet, tight curve. She leapt forward with a tremendous new impulse, her masts groaning, and settled on her new course, not deviating by a quarter of a point. She was heading exactly where he'd wanted it ahead, straight for the potential gap, and she was moving even faster than he'd hoped. The higher spars were bending like coach whips, just this side of carrying away. Mr. Stoughton, that was prettily executed. I am very pleased. The Surprise was tearing through the water, moving faster and faster, until she reached a steady 11 knots and the masts ceased their complaint. The backstays grew a shade less rigid, and leaning on one, gauging its tension as he stared at the Marengo, he said, "Main and fore royal stunsails." The Marengo was brisk in her motions, well manned, but the move had caught her unawares. She didn't begin her turn until the Surprise had set her royal stunsails and her masts were complaining again as they drove her 500 tons even faster through the sea. Her deck leaning sharply, her lee headrails buried in the foam, the sea roaring along her side, and the hands standing mute. Never a sound fore and aft. Yet when the Marengo did turn, she bore up hard to bring the wind on her starboard quarter, settling on a course that would give her beautiful deep-cut sails all possible thrust to intercept the Surprise at some point in the southwest. To cut her off, that is to say, if she couldn't find another knot or so. At the same time, the flagship sent up hoist after hoist of signals, some directed, no doubt, at the still-invisible corvette to leeward, and others to bring the Semillant and the Belle Poule pelting down after the Surprise. "They'll never do it, my friend," said Jack. "They didn't send up double preventer stays half an hour ago. They can't carry royals in this breeze." But he touched a belaying pin as he said so. Royals or no, the situation was tolerably delicate. The Marengo was moving faster than he'd expected, and the Belle Poule, whose earlier mistake had set her well to leeward, was nearer than he could wish. The two-decker and the heavy frigate were the danger. He had no chance at all against the Marengo, very little against the Belle Poule. And both these ships were fast converging upon his course. Each came on surrounded by an invisible ring 2 miles and more in diameter, the range of their powerful guns. The Surprise had to keep well out of these rings, above all out of the area where they would soon overlap, and the lane was closing fast. He considered her trim with the most intense concentration. It was possible that he was pressing her down a trifle aft, that there was a little too much canvas abroad driving her by force rather than by love. "Haul up the weather skirt of the main course," he said. Just so. That was distinctly sweeter, a more airy motion altogether. The dear Surprise had always loved her headsails. "Mr. Babington, jump forward and tell me whether the spritsail'll stand." "I doubt it, sir," said Babington, coming aft. "She throws such an almighty bow wave." Jack nodded. He thought as much. "Spritsail topsail, then," he said. And thank God for his new, strong royal mast that would take the strain. How beautifully she answered. You could ask anything of her. Yet still the lane was narrow enough in all conscience. The Marengo was crowding sail, and now the Surprise was racing into the zone of high danger. "Mr. Callow," he said to the signal midshipman, "strike the Dutch colours, hoist our own ensign and the pendant." The ensign broke out at the mizzen peak. A moment later, the pendant, the mark of a man of war and no other, streamed from the main. The Surprise was particular about her pendant, had renewed it 4 times this commission, adding a yard or two each time, and now its slim, tapering flame stretched out 60 feet, curving away beyond her starboard bow. At the sight, there was a general hum of satisfaction along the deck, where the men stood tense, strongly moved by the tearing speed. Now he was almost within random shot of the Marengo's bow guns. If he edged away, the Belle Poule and the Semillant would gain on him.
Could he afford to hold on to this present course? "Mr. Braithwaite," he said to the master's mate, "be so good as to heave the log." Braithwaite stepped forward, paused for a moment at the sloping lee quarter to see where he could toss it into a calm patch outside the mill race racing along her side, flung the log wide through the flying spray and shouted, "Turn!" The boy posted on the hammock netting with the reel held it high. The line tore off, and a moment later there was a shriek. The quartermaster had the boy by one foot, dragging him inboard, and the reel, torn from his hand, raced away astern. "Fetch another log, Mr. Braithwaite," said Jack with intense satisfaction, "and use a 14-second glass." He'd seen the whole line run off the reel only once in his life, when he was a midshipman, homeward bound in the packet from Nova Scotia. And the Flying Childers boasted of having done it too. The Childers also claimed to have lost their boy. But this was no time to be regretting the preservation of young Puddinghead Bent Larson, for although it was clear that at this speed they would do it, that they would cross the Marengo and start to increase the distance within a few minutes, yet nevertheless they were running towards the nearest point of convergence, and it was always possible to mistake by a few hundred yards. Would Lenoir fire? Yes. There was the flash and the puff of smoke. The ball fell short. The line was exact, but having skipped five times, the ball sank 300 yards away. So did the next two. And the fourth was even farther off. They were through. And now every minute sailed carried them farther out of range. "Yet I must not discourage him," said Jack, altering course to bring the surprise a little closer. "Mr. Stoughton, ease off the foresail sheet and hand the spritsail topsail. Mr. Callow, signal, enemy in sight, ship of the line corvette and brig bearing east, two frigates bearing nor-nor-west. Request orders, with a gun to windward. Keep it flying, and repeat the gun every 30 seconds. "Yes, sir." "Sir, may I say the corvette is bearing southeast now?" She was indeed. The lifting rainstorm showed her on the Surprise's larboard bow, well ahead of the Marengo and to leeward. The turning wind and the squall had set her half a mile to the west. Grave. Grave. It was in the corvette's power to bring him to action unless he edged away into the extreme range of the frigates. The Semillant had overhauled the Belpool once again. But to bring him to close action, the corvette would have to stand his raking fire, and it would need a most determined commander to take his ship right in against such odds. He would probably bear up, but long gunshot and exchange a distant broadside or two. Jack had no sort of objection to that. On the contrary, ever since he'd set the Surprise for the gap, showing what she could really do in the way of speed, giving away her qualities, he'd been trying to think of some means of leading Lenoir on in a hopeful chase that would take him far to the southward before nightfall. The signal was well enough in its way, but its effect wouldn't last. The drag sail would hardly take again. They must have smoked it. But a yard coming down with a run as though it had been shot away, why, that would answer, and he could give any of them a mizzen, or even the main topsail. "Mr. Babington, the corvette will engage us presently. When I give the word, let the main topsail come down with a run as though her fire had had effect. But neither the yard nor the sail must be hurt. So I'm putting on the cap, but I leave it to you. It must look like bedlam, all a hoo, and yet still be ready to set." It was just the kind of caper Babington would delight in. Jack had no doubt of his producing an elegant chaos. But he would have to go briskly to work. The Berceau was coming down under a cloud of canvas as fast as ever she could run.
and as Jack watched, he saw her set her fore-royal flying. She was steering to cross ahead of the Surprise. She lay on her beam at this moment, and although she was now within range, she held her fire. "Mr. Babington," cried Jack, without taking his eyes from the berceau, "should you like your hammock sent up?" Babington slid down a backstay, scarlet with toil and haste. "I'm sorry to have been so slow, sir," he said. "All is stretched along now, and I've left Harris and Old Reliable in the top, with orders to keep out of sight and let go handsomely when hailed." "Very good, Mr. Babington. Mr. Sturton, let us beat to quarters." At the thunder of the drum, Stephen took the startled chaplain by the arm and led him below. "This is your place in action, my dear sir," he said in the dimness. "These are the chests upon which Mr. Alistair and I operate, and these," waving the lantern towards them, "are the pledgets and tow and bandages with which you and Choles will second our endeavours. Does the sight of blood disturb you?"
"I have never seen it shed in any quantity."
"Then here's a bucket in case of need." Jack, Starton, and Etheridge were on the quarterdeck. Harrowby stood a little behind them, conning the ship. The other officers were at the guns, each to his own division. Every man silently watched the berceau as she ran down, a beautiful, trim little ship with scarlet topsides. She was head-on now, coming straight for the frigate's broadside. And Jack, watching closely through his glass, could see no sign of her meaning to bear up. The half-minute signal gun beside him spoke out again and again and again, and yet still the berceau came on into the certainty of a murderous raking fire. This was more determination than ever he'd reckoned on. He'd done the same himself in the Mediterranean, but that was against a Spanish frigate. Another 200 yards, and his heavy carronades would reach the berceau point blank. The signal gun again, and again. "Belay there," he said, and much louder. "Mr. Pullings! Mr. Pullings! A steady, deliberate fire now. Let the smoke clear between each shot. Point low on her foremast." A pause, and on the upward roll the purser's gun crashed out, the smoke sweeping ahead. A hole appeared in the corvette's spritzel, and a cheer went up, drowned by the second gun. "Steady, steady!" roared Jack, and Pullings ran down the line to point the third. The ball splashed close to the corvette's bow, and as it splashed, she answered with a shot from a chaser that struck the mainmast a glancing blow. The firing came down the line, a rippling broadside. Two shots went home in the corvette's bows, another hit her chains, and there were holes in her foresail. Now it began forward again, and as the range narrowed, so they hit her hard with almost every shot, or swept her deck from stem to stern. There were two guns dismounted aboard her and several men lying on the deck. Broadside after deliberate broadside, the whole ship quivering in the thunder, the jets of flame, the thick powder smoke racing ahead. Still the berceau held on, though her way was checked, and now her bow guns answered with chain shot that shrieked high through the rigging, cutting ropes and sails as it went. "A little more of this, and I shan't need my caper," thought Jack. "Can he mean to lay me aboard? Mr. Pullings, Mr. Babington, briskly now, and grape the next round. Mr. Etheridge, the Marines may—" His words were cut off by a furious cheer. The berceau's foretop mast was going. It gave a great forward lurch. The stays and shrouds parted, and it fell in a ruin of canvas masking the corvette's forward guns. "Hold hard!" he cried. "Maintop there, let go!" The Surprise's topsail billowed out, came down, collapsed. And across the water,
They heard a thin, answering cheer from the shattered corvette. A foreign gun sent a hail of grape along the Berceau's deck, knocking down a dozen men and cutting away her colours. "Cease fire there, God rot you all in hell!" cried Jack. "Secure those guns! Mr. Stoughton, hands to knot and splice!" "She struck!" said a voice in the waist, as the surprise swept on. The Berceau hulled again and again, low in the water and by the head, swung heavily round, and they saw a figure running up the mizzen, shrouds with fresh colours. Jack took his hat off to her captain, standing there on his bloody quarterdeck 70 yards away. The Frenchman returned the salute. But still, as his remaining larboard guns came to bear, he fired a ragged broadside after the frigate, and then, as she reached the limit of his range, another, in a last attempt at preventing her escape. A vain attempt. Not a shot came home, and the surprise was still far ahead of the Marengo on her larboard quarter, and the two frigates away to starboard. Jack glanced at the sun. No more than an hour to go, alas. They couldn't hope to lead them very far this moonless night, if indeed he could lead them at all for what was left of the day. "Mr. Babington, take your party into the top and give the appearance of trying to get things ship-shape. You may cockbill the yard. Mr. Callow, where is that midshipman?"
"He was carried below, sir," said Stoughton.
"Hit on the head."
"Mr. Lee, then. Signal partial engagement, heavy damage, request assistance, enemy bearing nor-nor-east and nor-nor-west, and carry on with a half-minute gun. Mr. Stoughton, a fire in the waist would do no harm, plenty of smoke. One of the coppers filled with slush and tow might answer. Let there be some turmoil." He walked to the taffrail and surveyed the broad sea astern. The brig had gone to the assistance of the Berceau. The Marengo maintained her position on the larboard quarter, coming along at a fine pace and perhaps gaining a little. As he expected, she was signalling to the Semillon to the Belle Poule. A talkative nation, though gallant. And she was no doubt telling them to make more sail, for the Belle Poule set her main royal, which instantly carried away. For the moment, everything was well in hand. He went below. "Dr. Maturin," he said, "what is your casualty list?"
3 splinter wounds, so none serious, I'm happy to report, and 1 moderate concussion."
"How is Mr. Callow?"
"There he is on the floor, on the deck, just behind you. A block fell upon his head."
"Shall you open his skull?" asked Jack, with a vivid recollection of Stephen trepanning the gunner on the quarter-deck of the Sophie, exposing his brains to the admiration of all.
"No, oh no, I'm afraid his condition wouldn't justify the step. He'll do very well as he is. Now, Jenkins here had a truly narrow escape with his splinter. When Alistair and I cut it out..."
"Which it came off of the hounds of the mainmast, sir," said Jenkins, holding up a wickedly sharp piece of wood, 2 feet long. "We found his innominate artery pulsing against its tip. The 20th part of an inch more, or a trifling want of attention, and William Jenkins would have become an involuntary hero."
"Well done, Jenkins," said Jack. "Well done indeed." And he went on to inquire after the other two. "A forearm laid open and an ugly scalp wound."
"Is this Mr. White?"
"Catching sight of another body."
"Yes, he was a little overcome when we raised John Sadler's scalp, and desired him to hold it while we sewed it on. Yet there was virtually no blood. A passing syncope. He will be quite recovered by a little fresh air. May he go on deck presently?" "Oh, this minute, if he chooses. We had a slight brush with the corvette. Such a gallant fellow. He came on most amazingly until Mr. Bowes brought his foremast by the board. But now we're running before the wind, far out of range. Let him go on deck by all means." On deck, the black smoke was belching from the frigate's waist, streaming away ahead of her. The ship's boys were hurrying about with swabs, buckets, and the fire engine. Babington was roaring, cursing in the top, waving his arms. All hands looked pleased with themselves and sly, and the pursuers had gained a quarter of a mile. Far on the starboard beam, the sun was sinking behind a blood-red haze. Sinking, sinking, and it was gone. Already the night was sweeping up from the east, a starless night with no moon, and pale phosphorescent fire had begun to gleam in the frigate's wake. After sunset, when the French sails were no more than the faintest hint of whiteness far astern, to be fixed only by the recurrent flash of the admiral's top-lantern, the Surprise sent up a number of blue lights, set her undamaged main topsail, and ran fast and faster south-westwards. At 8 bells in the first watch, she hauled to the wind in the pitchy darkness, and having given his orders for the night, Jack said to Stephen, "We must turn in and get what sleep we can. I expect a busy day tomorrow." "Do you feel that Monsieur de Lenoir is not wholly deceived?" "I hope he is, I'm sure. He ought to be, and he's certainly come after us as if he were. But he's a deep old file, a thoroughgoing seaman, and I shall be glad to see nothing to the east of us when we join the China fleet in the morning." "Do you mean he might dart about and fling himself between us, guided by mere intuition? Surely that would argue a prescience in the admiral exceeding the limits of our common humanity. The thoroughgoing seaman is not necessarily a seer. Attention to the nice adjustment of the sails is one thing, vaticination another. Honest, Jack, if you snore in that deep, pragmatical fashion, Sophie is going to spend many an uneasy night." "It occurs to me," he said, looking at his friend, who, according to his long-established habit, had plunged straight into the dark, comfortable pit of sleep from which nothing would rouse him but the cry of a sail or a change in the wind. "It occurs to me that our race must have a natural propensity to ugliness. You're not an ill-looking fellow, and were almost handsome before you were so pierced, blown up, and banged by the enemy, and so exposed to the elements. And you are to marry a truly beautiful young woman. Yet I make no doubt you will, between you, produce little common babies that mule, pule, and roar, all in that same tedious, deeply vulgar, self-centred monotone, drool, cut their teeth, and grow up into plain blockheads. Generation after generation, and no increase in beauty, none in intelligence. On the analogy of dogs, or even of horses, the rich should stand 9 foot high, and the poor run about under the table. This does not occur. Yet the absence of improvement never stops men desiring the company of beautiful women. Not indeed that when I think of Diana I have the least notion of children. I should never voluntarily add to the unhappiness of the world by bringing even more people into it in any case. But even if that were in my mind, the idea of Diana as a mother is absurd. There is nothing maternal about her whatsoever. Her virtues are of another kind." He turned the wick down to a small line of blue flame and crept onto the steeply sloping deck, where he wedged himself between a coil of rope and the side, and watched the dim, tearing sea, the clearing sky with stars blazing in the gaps of cloud, reflecting upon Diana's virtues, defining them, and listening to the successive bells and the responding cry of "All's well" right round the ship, until the first lightning of the eastern sky.
"I've brought you a mug of coffee, Doctor," said Pullings, looming at his side. "And when you've drunk it up, I'm going to call the skipper. He will be most uncommon pleased." He still spoke in his quiet night-watch voice, although the idlers had been called already and the ship was filling with activity. "What would please him, Sir Thomas Pullings?" "You are a good creature, to be sure, to bring me this laboratory-stimulating drink. I'm obliged to you. What will please him, so?" "Why, the Indiaman's top lights have been in sight this last glass and more, and when dawn comes, I dare say we shall see them a-shaking out the reef in their topsails just exactly where you reckon to find them. Such artful navigation you'd scarcely credit. He's come at the Tom Cox's traverse over Lenoir." Jack appeared, and the spreading light showed 40 sail of merchantmen stretched wide along the western sea. He smiled and opened his mouth to speak, when the spreading light also betrayed the surprise to a distant vessel in the east, which instantly burst into a perfect frenzy of gunfire like a small and solitary battle. "Jump up the masthead, Braithwaite," he said, "and tell me what you make of her." The expected answer came floating down. "That French brig, sir, signalling like fury, and I believe I make out a sail bearing something north of her." It was just as he had feared. Lenoir had sent the brig northwards early in the night, and now she was reporting the presence of the surprise, if not of the China fleet, to her friends over the horizon. The long-drawn-out ruse had failed. He'd meant to draw Lenoir so far to the south and west during the night that the surprise, doubling back towards the China fleet in the darkness, would be far out of sight by morning. With the frigate's great speed, and how they'd cracked on, he should have done it. Yet he had not. Either one of the French squadron had caught the gleam of her sails as she ran northwards through the pursuing line, or Lenoir had an intuition that something was amiss, that he was being attempted to be made a fool of, and had called off the chase, sending the brig back to his old cruising ground and then following her with the rest of his ships after an hour or so, crowding sail for the track of the China fleet. Yet his ruse had not failed entirely. It had gained essential time. How much time? Jack set course for the Indiaman and made his way into the cross-trees. The accursed brig lay some 4 leagues off, still carrying on like a Guy Fawkes night, and the farther sail perhaps as much again. He would scarcely have seen her but for the purity of the horizon at this hour, which magnified the nick of her t'gallants in the line of brilliant sky. He had no doubt that she was one of the frigates, and that the whole of Lenoir's squadron, less the corvette, were strung out on the likely passage of the Indiaman. They could outsail the convoy, and with this unvarying monsoon there was no avoiding them. But they could not outsail the convoy by a great deal. And it would take Lenoir the greater part of the day to concentrate his force and come up with the China fleet. The senior captains came hurrying aboard the Surprise, headed by Mr. Muffet, their commodore. The signal flying from the frigate's main truck and the commodore's energetic gathering of the stragglers had given them a general idea of the situation. They were anxious, disturbed, grave, but some, alas, were also garrulous, given to exclamation, to blaming the authorities for not protecting them, and to theories about where Lenoir had really been all this time. The company's service was a capable, disciplined body, but its regulations required the commodore to listen to the views of his captains in council before any decisive action. And like all councils of war, this was wordy, indefinite, inclined to pessimism. Jack had never so regretted the superior rigour of the Royal Navy as he did during the vague discourse of a Mr. Craig,
who was concerned to show what might have been the case had they not waited for the Botany Bay ship and the two Portuguese. "Gentlemen," cried Jack at last, addressing himself to the three or four other determined men at the table, "this is no time for talking. There are only two things for it. We must either run or fight. If you run, Lenoir will snap up your fleet piecemeal, for I can only stop one of his frigates, while the Marengo can sail 5 leagues to your three and blow any two of you out of the water. If we fight, if we concentrate our force, we can answer him gun for gun." "Who's to fight the guns?" asked a voice. "I'll come to that, sir. What is more, Lenoir is a year out of a dockyard, and he's 3,000 miles from the Isle of France. He is short of stores, and single spar or 50 fathom of 2-inch rope is of 100 times more consequence to him than it is to us. I doubt there's a spare topmast in his whole squadron. In duty, he must not risk grave damage. He must not press home his attack against a determined resistance." "How do you know he's not refitted in Batavia?" "We'll leave that for the moment, if you please," said Jack. "We have no time to lose. Here's my plan. You have 3 more ships than Lenoir reckoned for. The 3 best-armed ships will wear men-of-war pendants and the blue ensign. We're not allowed to wear Royal Navy colours. Will you give me leave to proceed, sir? That is entirely my responsibility, and I will take it upon myself to give the necessary permission. The larger Indiamen will form in line of battle, taking all available men out of the rest of the convoy to work the guns and sending the smaller ships away to leeward. I shall send an officer aboard each ship supposed to be a man of war and all the quarter gunners I can spare. With a close, well-formed line, our numbers are such that we can double upon his van or rear and overwhelm him with numbers. With 1 or 2 of your fine ships on one side of him and surprise on the other, I'll answer for it if we can beat the 74, let alone the frigates." "Hear him! Hear him!" cried Mr. Muffet, taking Jack by the hand. "That's the spirit, God's my life!" In the confusion of voices, it became clear that, although there was eager and indeed enthusiastic support, one captain even beating the table and roaring, "We'll thump 'em again and again," there were others who were not of the same opinion. Who'd ever heard of merchant ships with encumbered decks and few hands holding out for 5 minutes against powerful men of war? Most of them had only miserable 18-pounder cannonades. The far, far better plan was to separate. Some would surely escape. The Dorsetshire was certain she could outrun the French. Could the gentleman give any example of a ship with a 270-pound broadside resisting an enemy that could throw 950 pounds? "Whisht, Mr. Craig," said Muffet, before Jack could reply. "Do you not know Captain Aubrey's the gentleman who commanded the Sophie brig when she took the Cacafuego, a 32-gun frigate? And I believe Sir Sophie threw no great broadside."
28 pounds,
said Jack, reddening.
"Why," cried Craig, "I spoke only out of my duty to the company. I honour the gentleman, I'm sure, and I'm sorry I didn't just recollect his name. He'll not find me shy, I believe. I spoke only for the company and my cargo, not for myself." "I believe, gentlemen," said Muffet, "that the sense of the council is in favour of Captain Aubrey's plan, as I am myself. I hear no dissension voice. Gentlemen, I desire you will repair aboard your ships, fill powder, clear away your guns, and attend to Captain Aubrey's signals."
Aboard the Surprise, Jack called his officers to the cabin and said, "Mr. Pullings, you will proceed to the Lushington Indiaman with Collins, Haverhill, and Polyblank. Mr. Babington to Royal George with the Brothers Moss. Mr. Braithwaite to the brig to repeat signals. Take the spare set with you. Mr. Bowes, can I persuade you to look to the Earl Camden's guns? I know you can point them better than any of us."
The purser flushed bright with pleasure and chuckled.
If the captain wished, he would certainly abandon his cheese and candles, though he didn't know how he should like it. And he begged for Evans and Strawberry Joe.
"That's settled, then," said Jack. "Now, gentlemen, this is a delicate business. We must not offend the company's officers, and some of them are very touchy. The least sense of ill-feeling would be disastrous. The men must be made to understand that thoroughly. No pride, no distance, no reference to tea wagons or how we do things in the Navy. Our one aim must be to keep their guns firing briskly, to engage Lenoir closely, and to wound his spars and rigging as much as ever we can. Hulling him or killing his people is beside the point. He'd give his bosun for a stunsail boom. And with the best will in the world, we shall never sink a 74. We must fire like Frenchmen for once. Mr. Stoughton, you and I will work out a list of the gunners we can spare, and while I'm sharing them among the Indiamen, you will take the ship to the eastward and watch Lenoir's motions." Within an hour, the line had formed. 15 handsome Indiamen under easy sail a cable's length apart, and a fast-sailing brig to repeat signals. Boats plied to and from the smaller ships, bringing volunteers for the guns. And all that forenoon Jack hurried up and down the line in his barge, dispensing officers, gunners, discreet advice and encouragement, and stores of affability. This affability was rarely forced, for most of the captains were right seamen. And given their fiery commodore's strong lead, they set to with a determination that made Jack love them. Decks were clearing fast. The three ships chosen for pendants, the Lushington, the Royal George, and the Earl Camden, began to look even more like men-of-war, with whitewashers over their sides disguising them fast, and royal yards crossed. And the guns ran in and out without a pause. Yet there were some awkward captains, lukewarm, despondent, and reserved. Two of them, timid old fools. And the passengers were the cruelest trial. Atkins and the other members of Mr. Stanhope's suite could be dealt with, but the women and the important civilians called for personal interviews and for explanations. One lady, darting from an unlikely hatch, told him she should countenance no violence whatsoever. Lenoir should be reasoned with. His passions would certainly yield to reason. And Jack was kept very busy. It was only from time to time, as he sat in the barge next to Church, his solemn aide-de-camp, that he had leisure to ponder the remark, "How do you know he has not refitted in Batavia?" He didn't know it. Yet his whole strategy must be based upon that assumption. He didn't know it, but still he was willing to risk everything upon his intuitions being sound, for it was a matter of intuition. Lenoir's cautious handling of his ship, 1,000 details that Jack could hardly name, but that contrasted strongly with the carefree Lenoir of the Mediterranean, with Toulon and its naval stores a few days' sail away. Yet moral certainty could fade. He was not infallible, and Lenoir was old in war, a resourceful, dangerous opponent. Dinner aboard the Lushington with Captain Muffet was a relief. Not only was Jack desperately sharp-set, having missed his breakfast, but Muffet was a man after his own heart. They saw eye to eye on the formation of the line, the way to conduct the action, aggressive tactics rather than defence, and on the right dinner to restore a worn and badgered spirit. Church appeared while they were drinking coffee. "Surprise signalling, sir, if you please," he said. "Semillant, Marengo and Belle Poule bearing east by south about 4 leagues. Marengo is back topsails." "He's waiting for Belsa to come up," said Jack. "We shall not see him for an hour or two. What do you say, sir, to a turn on deck?"
Left alone, the midshipman silently devoured the remains of the pudding, pocketed two French rolls, and darted after his captain, who was standing with the Commodore on the poop, watching the last boats pull away from the line, filled with passengers bound for the hypothetical safety of the Leeward Division. "I cannot tell you so," said Muffet in a low voice. "What a feeling of peace it gives me to see them go. Deep, abiding peace. You gentlemen have your admirals and commissioners, no doubt, and indeed the enemy to bring your spirits low, but passengers, captained and are mice in this ship. They have et my bonnet and two pairs of gloves. I shall complain to the directors. My cousin is a director, sir. Captain, why cannot I get a soft-boiled egg in this ship? I told the young man at Inger House my child couldn't possibly be expected to digest a hard yolk. Captain, there are no cupboards, no drawers in my room, nowhere to hang anything, no room, no room, no room. Do you hear me, sir? There'll be all the room you merit where you're going to. 10 brimstone shrews packing into one cabin in a country ship. How I love to see 'em go. The distance can't be too great for me. Let us increase it, then. Give them leave to part company, throw out the signal to tack in succession again, and there you have two birds in one bush. It's a poor heart that never rejoices. The flags ran up, the ships to leeward acknowledged and made sail, and the line prepared to go about. First the Alfred, then the Coutts, then the Wexford, and now the Lushington. As she approached the troubled wake where the Wexford had begun her turn, Mr. Muffet took over from his chief mate and put her about himself, smooth, steady, and exact. The Lushington swung through 90 degrees, and the Surprise came into view on her port bow. The sight of her low, checkered hull and her towering masts lifted Jack's heart, and his grave face broke into a loving smile. But after this second's indulgence, his eyes searched beyond her, and there, clear on the horizon, were the topgallant sails of Lenoir's squadron. The Lushington steadied on her course. Mr. Muffet stepped back from the rail, mopping his face, for the turn had brought the sun full onto the poop, where the awning had long since been replaced by splinter netting, which gave no protection from the fiery beams. He hurried to the side and stood watching the centre and the rear. The line was reformed, heading southeast, with the larboard tacks aboard, a line of ships 1.5 miles long, lying between the enemy and the rest of the convoy. A line of concentrated fire, nowhere strong, but moderately formidable from its quantity and from the mutual support of the close order. A trim line, too. The Ganges and the Bombay Castle were sagging away a little to leeward, but their intervals were correct. The East India captains could handle their ships, of that there was no doubt. They'd performed this manoeuvre 3 times already, and never had there been a blunder nor even a hesitation. Slow, of course, compared with the Navy, but uncommon sure. They could handle their ships. Could they fight them too? That was the question. "I admire the regularity of your line, sir," said Jack. "The Channel Fleet couldn't keep station better." "I'm happy to hear you say so," said Muffet. "We may not have your heavy crews, but we do try to do things seamanlike. They're between you and me and the binnacle," he added in a personal aside. "I dare say the presence of your people may have something to do with it. There's not one of us wouldn't sooner lose an eye tooth than miss stays with a king's officer looking on." "That reminds me," said Jack, "should you dislike wearing the king's coat for the occasion, you and the gentlemen who are to have pendants?" "Lenoir's devilish sly, and if his spyglass picks up the company's uniform in ships that are supposed to be men of war, he'll smoke what we're about. It might encourage him to make a bolder stroke than we should care for." It was a wounding suggestion. It was not happily expressed. Muffet felt it keenly.